I'm Christopher Lydon with a rising young Indian writer's take on his country, a place of grueling poverty still, but transfixed by new wealth, consumed by both euphoria and dread. He says Mahatma Gandhi's India that our parents knew, the peace politics, the democratic socialism in a nation of villages, is very nearly gone and forgotten. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. And this is the second chapter of the story from a parade of seers in Brown's Year of India. Rana Dasgupta is our guest. Salman Rushdie, no less, calls Dasgupta the most original Indian writer of his generation. Born in England, actually, 38 years ago, returned to his father's land at the start of the new century to write the new India in fiction and fact. He begins our conversation here with a true tale that's also symbolic. The public scandal of a reckless boy prince of the new money, drunk in his $150,000 BMW a few years ago, slicing through seven people, killing six of them, but still rich and unrepentant enough to buy his freedom from punishment for a while. It's for Rana Dasgupta to tell the whole story.
This was a guy called Sanjeev Nanda, who was the son, interestingly, of a prominent arms dealer, somebody who had left behind a military career to do what a lot of senior military people do, which is to basically broker arms deals. That is the kind of work that has created a lot of fortunes in Delhi. It's a very Delhi kind of job because you need political connections at the very heart of the establishment in order to be able to make these deals, in order to be credible as an arms dealer. And you rake off enormous profits from each of these deals. So Sanjeev Nanda came from this kind of stock. He was one night driving his BMW along one of the principal thoroughfares of the city. People said afterwards he was driving at 140 kilometers an hour. There was a police checkpoint set up on this road, which he smashed through, killing policemen and some laborers who were also being stopped and questioned at the checkpoint. It's very difficult to know exactly what happened, but according to reports and witnesses, it seems that he and his friend got out of the car, looked at this wreckage that they have just created. It's bodies were thrown enormous distances and body parts from the car. Were horrified and terrified at what they saw. Got back in the car, ran over another body as they departed quickly, and drove to a friend's house very nearby, where they had the car cleaned, hosed down by the guard of this house, and made to lay low. Unfortunately, the police followed the trail of blood and leaking oil from this car and found them and arrested Sanjeev Nanda, who was still drunk, and took him into jail. This kind of story is not uncommon in cities like this, where the road is not really made for cars to travel at that kind of speed, because the road is still a very, very varied zone. It's got people selling stuff and sleeping, and all kinds of things are going on in the roads. What makes this story mythical is the fact that Sanjeev Nanda then managed to, through his family connections, essentially shut down the entire legal process and evade any kind of legal consequence for many, many years by paying off witnesses. One witness completely disappeared and no one knows what happened to him. Sanjeev Nanda essentially resumed his normal life. He went to the school in Paris, at INSEAD. He came back and took over the hotel branch of the family business, whilst everyone knew exactly what had happened. And it took a sting operation by a media company to finally uncover what had happened and reopen the case. So what does this story show? I mean, it shows symbolically Sanjeev Nanda kind of incarnates a certain kind of expectation that already existed in the city, that this is what our elite looks like. They are venal and reckless. They're drunk. They drive foreign cars. They have no interest in the kind of local mores or or constraints. They just want to smash through all those things for their own pleasure. And when things go wrong, they will never pay the price. They will always be able to ensure that the political and legal establishment backs them up and endorses their innocence. But it also, the story also shows that India is a place where, despite the fact that it does have this extraordinarily powerful and almost immune elite, also has a civil society that is outraged by these things and in its own kind of ramshackle way manages in the end to get them. The fact is that Sanjeev Nanda did go to jail. He went only for 5 years, but that is being appealed and he may go for longer. And it does show something about the kind of way that Indian society operates, that a strange coalition of media and civil society and unhappy lawyers finds some means in the end to get this guy, even though the police and the normal infrastructure has failed to do so.
In this year of India, at universities, in the White House, I'm still trying to dope out the picture. Part of it begins with those pictures of President Obama and Prime Minister Singh together. Prime Minister Singh is presented on television as kind of the old Indian Swami, turban-headed, traditional leader of a traditional society. In fact, he was also the finance minister who opened up India almost 20 years ago to new investment of a radically different sort. Where do we go for the whole story?
Manmohan Singh has a serene, almost robotic exterior. His impact on India has been anything but serene. His impact has been radical and turbulent. He is the man most single-handedly responsible for the immense eruption of economic energies that have dominated Indian cities and society for the last 20 years. And indeed, under his prime ministership, those energies continue to expand and to take over the country more and more. If one's to take a bird's-eye view of what's going on in India right now, we can compare it to what happened in Europe in the 19th century. We are going through in India many of these same processes where essentially a rural population is being reorganized into an urban industrial population with all the turbulence and violence that process in implies. The things that we see in India right now do seem, on the face of them, to be very, very violent. Indian political and civil society is split over the question of how much we want progress, how much we want our stock market to mushroom, how much we want all these things, and what price are we prepared to pay for them. So, for instance, one of the big things that's splitting these kind of debates right now is the question of mines. There are lots of mining companies who are coming in to mine the extremely rich mineral resources that exist in some of the poorest states of India, in Jharkhand, in Chhattisgarh, in Orissa. And these mineral deposits exist mainly in tribal areas. These tribal communities have lived in these areas for hundreds or thousands of years, and in many cases have a sacred geography of these mountains where the bauxite is. In order to get this land, the government has been trying to basically evict these guys who don't want to be evicted. And as the pressure has grown from these enormous mining companies for the Indian government to take control of this land, the violence has escalated quite a lot. A lot of people have been shot in protests over the land. And in the worst cases, there have been state/corporate militia who have gone and burned villages, killed people, threatened them, and all that kind of stuff. And it is generating more human fuel for the extremely large and significant Maoist rebellion that's dominating a lot of eastern India. A very, very large proportion of India's land surface is now in some kind of disorder, whether it is Maoist insurgency, northeastern insurgency, various kinds of militancy in Kashmir, which is all to do with precisely this kind of mushrooming of economic energies.
Even the land takings around New Delhi that you write about partake of something of this rapaciousness. It's not quite the same, but...
Yeah, I mean, essentially, when land is to be turned over to something like a shopping mall or an industrial complex or a mine, it has to be taken from somebody. And in contemporary India, no one wants to give up land. Because if you give up land as a farmer, especially in some of the very, very fertile areas that some of the big corporations are trying to get, you exchange that land for a certain future as a factory worker, a security guard. You have basically a completely uncertain kind of livelihood. So why would you want to do that? You have to be forced into it. So violence is a necessary part of this equation. But at the same time, I think that because India is a democracy, because at the end of the day, these people who are getting kicked out have votes, and votes are incredibly important to the political establishment, I would say that the violence is a fraction of what Europe was capable of in the 19th century, where essentially they were not democracies, and they were operating outside their own nation states in colonial territories where they had no responsibilities whatsoever.
I love your thought that India is going through a process that took England a century, say, and it's really the period between Dickens's Pickwick Papers and the poverty of London that he chronicled too later in Bleak House and Great Expectations and whatnot. Where do we go for the Dickens of India's process now, this unbelievably articulate country full of now famous writers? Who will tell the story? Where do we Americans go to hear the story, not just of the poor, but also of the soul of the society, in a sense?
In a way, I think the intensity of the events, political and cultural, that we've all felt in the last 10 or 20 years in India, I would say that there are not really that many cultural expressions that quite match, quite live up to this intensity. And I still think that the great films and books still need to be made to express the full range of events and feelings and currents that there are in the country. We live essentially slung between horror and euphoria, and these are the two things that are always going on. We can balance these all the time. I don't think one wants to take away from the fact that there is immense vitality. The vitality and the ambition that one sees in India right now is unbelievable. It is a force that will definitely have absolutely global consequences because it cannot be contained. And there is a rush to seeing cities being built up very fast and seeing people's lives being transformed and seeing a whole country sort of change its whole global relationship. And at the same time, one sees a lot of other people paying the price for this, and that's the kind of constant cycle one is in.
Millions of Americans know India mainly through Slumdog Millionaire. Do you want to guide us in reading that movie as a sort of key to India today?
There's a slick brilliance to the conceit of the movie, and I think when I find the film is most interesting and revealing is where it captures a certain paradox of contemporary Indian feeling. And that paradox is that, if you remember, the man who is winning all this money on this game show is able to answer the questions only through sheer coincidence, that he has lived through an event, usually a traumatic event, that has supplied the answer to his question, because he's a completely uneducated man. So what happens is that he's just won a new level of financial reward, and the audience is clapping. And in a sense, it's a moment of total plenitude. He's getting everything that contemporary India promises: fame, money, and the acclaim of everyone around him. And in the process, his face is ashen, and he is, because he has just been forced to think back on the worst things that have ever happened to him, and he is plunged into tragedy and trauma. I think that this is actually an acute rendition of contemporary Indian reality, that the accumulation and progress of contemporary India does hark back to India's most painful, the most painful moments of individuals and of the nation. And part of the intensity with which that acquisition of wealth has been pursued is due to the fact that there is this very powerful memory of trauma. I liked that about the film. I was turned off by the reviews I saw in a lot of the Western press, which praised it as a kind of rip-roaring, fun celebration of contemporary India and love and happiness and all these kind of things. You have to have some kind of defense mechanism against that trauma and to dismiss its reality if you are to come away from the film thinking that it's essentially a feel-good movie, which is what I saw a lot of the blurbs said about it, a feel-good movie where people have had their eyes put out by acid and in order that they can earn more money singing as a blind man on the side of the street. It was not a feel-good movie at all. So I thought the film was a decent film that had interesting moments, but it snowballed into something else completely in the press, which I found a bit ugly.
Rana Dasgupta, your piece in Granta last summer was a real wake-up call for me about Delhi especially, a city consumed both by euphoria and dread, you wrote, a city transfixed by wealth, with grueling poverty never very far away. Just walk us around that Delhi.
I think it's very difficult for people who haven't been to a city like, say, Delhi or Bombay, to comprehend the incredible diversity of life forms in the city, which includes not only the very rich and the globally traveled, they include the rural migrants from all over the country speaking hundreds of different kinds of languages, having many, many different kinds of religious practices. They include wandering bands of eunuchs, musicians, healers. They include all kinds of animal residents of the cities, cows, elephants, camels, monkeys. These are cities that have never gone through this whole Western process of homogenization and rationalization. Well, they have, and they are going through these processes, but they are as yet diverse to an extent that would be inconceivable in a 21st century Western city. That variety is very much the joy, I think, of living in Indian cities. The feeling that everyone is just like you, the feeling that your life is a kind of replication of many, many other lives, and that all life has essentially been rationalized and homogenized, is certainly not a feeling that one has in contemporary Indian cities. They retain the feeling of kind of historic abundance, of living in close proximity to people who have so little in common with you that you are almost unable to recognize each other as fellow human beings. And India itself, as a nation state, it's better to compare it to Europe than it is to, say, France. It could have been like Europe. Had the British not colonized it into one nation, it could have fragmented into many, many nations. But it has hundreds of languages, many kinds of cuisine and local cultures. It's very, very difficult, I think, to make meaningful generalizations about the place.
In all the stories of Bangalore, the new India, billionaire India, industrial India, global India, I keep wondering, where is that India I grew up with, the post-colonial India, Nehru's India, non-aligned, thorn in American sides India, but was really the child of Gandhi?
I think, you know, it's a very interesting question. India in becoming Manmohan Singh's India, in becoming globalized, liberalized India, has become quite amnesiac and is very, very quickly laid to rest its recent past. So in one sense, you can say that that India has disappeared or is disappearing as fast as people can make it disappear. And the whole socialist era from 1947 until 1991 is one that people are like to forget and to make disappear. And the whole socialist infrastructure of kind of crumbling public buildings and bad public facilities and queues and booking things that never arrive, and that whole lifestyle is much satirized and rejected now in contemporary India. With it goes also a lot of the idealism of that period. So the urban relationship to rural India, which for Gandhi, certainly, and Nehru in a different sense, was very much at the core of his idea of the nation, and bringing urban and rural populations into a mutually beneficial and meaningful relationship with each other was at the center of what Nehru was trying to do. That whole project is very difficult to see anymore in India, and urban populations have essentially disavowed their rural compatriots. Mm. And politicians are, to a great extent, just destroying the countryside, even as they try to sustain it. But I would also say that there is, in a different sense, a great persistence of the post-colonial mentality. For a long time, Indians under colonialism, and then newly independent India, were very, very acute critics of power. They were acute critics of the way that British power operated amongst them, and they remained suspicious of imperial power always. And I think that today's generation of intellectuals and writers and artists, one of the things that they bring to the global table is that though this original anti-colonial sentiment has kind of grown into different or has taken on different objects, it is still very acute. Indian intellectuals understand power very, very well, and they are sensitive to the ways that it operates in the world.
That's exactly what I've been listening for through the Bush years and the Iraq War, even now in the Obama time and the question of Afghanistan. I'm listening for that Nehru or Krishna Menon suspicion of power, suspicion of military domination as a kind of not just tweaking and teasing the Americans, but kind of confronting the United States' own power in the region. Am I missing something, or is that just dropped out of the conversation?
I think in the last few years, with the nuclear deal between America and India, Indian politicians have not really wanted to confront America about anything. They have, and they have been rather silent on issues of. I think I'm right in saying they didn't send troops to Iraq. They refused to send troops to Iraq. But they have not wanted to confront America about these kind of things. And in fact, they have been lobbying and seducing America over the nuclear deal very effectively. I mean, the whole Washington and New York Indian lobby circuit was amazing over the nuclear deal. Whatever you thought of the nuclear deal, India outplayed America on it. And it was a very, very successful and well-organized maneuver. But I think the place to look for this kind of thing is not in politics. It's in the private sphere. It's in the work of people like Arundhati Roy, who has been a very, very outspoken critic of Bush. And to some extent, though the Indian press does have glimmers of it, I think just in private conversation.
So what remains in the end of a post-colonial or anti-imperial impulse in the new India?
One of the guys I interviewed in my grant article was a 26-year-old man who had at his disposal a couple of billion dollars because his father had was a liquor baron, had made a huge amount of money off liquor retail in rural India. And this guy had built an empire of real estate in India. He had a large amount of cash that he was looking to invest, and he couldn't find plots of land big enough in India, because accessing the plots of farmers and parceling them all together is very, very complex. They're quite well legally protected. So he found out in the conversation of the international elite that the president of Ethiopia was selling off massive parcels of land. So he bought 750,000 acres from the president of Ethiopia in order to grow food. As a side note, a lot of these people who have come out, once again, I say it, of very, very traumatic situations and very insecure situations, they understand the economy in these incredibly simple ways. He said to me, there are only three industries. There is food, medicine, and education. That's what everyone needs. You have to be, if you want to be a big player, you have to somehow have a stake in these three. And they're businessmen. They know that the real estate boom will end, but people will never stop eating. So he is setting up this big plantation in Africa. He's shipping out farmers from India to man the whole thing because he hasn't got time to train African farmers to farm many, many thousands of acres at a time. And he wants to become, in the next 5 years, the fourth largest food processing company in the world, and eventually to buy Heinz because he hates American companies and he'd like to take over one. And that impulse is a strongly post-colonial impulse. He wants to get back at the world and own it. And through wealth and commercial mastery to reclaim a history of subjugation, which he takes very personally, though in his own life, he's only 26, there has been no subjugation at all. And I asked this guy, what would it be like to live in a world which was controlled by Indian corporations and Indian capitalists? And he said, oh, it would be more spiritual. And then he thought for a moment and he said, no, it would be exactly the same.
That's brilliant. President Obama says this relationship, the United States and India, is going to be the shining example of global connections for the rest of time. How's it going to feel to us folk on the street in the United States, do you suppose? Who is it we are dancing with suddenly?
The fact is that India and America have very, very profound similarities and a very obvious kind of relationship. Both countries are based around a grand political idea. They're not based around any kind of racial homogeneity or anything like that. They are based around a constitution and a moment of independence from the British. In both countries, a desire to be left alone to run your business is a very powerful feeling. There is suspicion in both countries of governments and all the interferences that they make into private, commercial life. And it's precisely for this reason that so many Indians have been so successful in America. They don't even have to stop at the airport to understand where they've come. They already know it. Mm-hmm. They have understood America deeply before they've arrived. This has been enhanced in the last 2 decades by the fact that the elite of India now automatically sends its children, its kids, to study in the US. There is a very, very vast number of Indian teenagers who come here to study, to the extent, I think, that the Indian elite now regards the United States as its other territory. This is where people come and spend 4 years of their lives, and then they stay or they come back, but definitely their education will be here. So they come back with certain American perspectives on Indian society, which Americanizes Indian society still further. the way that cafes look, the much of the landscape of the new India is self-consciously Indian, American. There are also ways in which America and India differ profoundly. America is a society of systems. It's a society of there should be nothing that eludes the eye of the state. The systems of policing, control, rationalization should reach into every corner of each city and each part of the nation state. That is clearly not the case in India. In India, the state has only the most partial and patchy understanding of what is going on within the borders of the state. It cannot look into all these areas. And Indians are not particularly uncomfortable about this. Indians accept that things cannot be systematized, that there is inherent chaos, that you don't have to understand your neighbor. He may live an incredibly different life from yours, but that's not a problem. The incredible ramshackle bric-a-brac nature of Indian cities, where slums are next to high-rise apartment blocks and all these kind of things, is not felt to be a great shock. And the fact that people hack into electricity systems to run their slums, lights and all those kinds of things, is kind of treated with wry humor by middle-class Indians. So I don't know how these things will play out. I suspect that they will play out very much to Indians' advantage, because Indians will be much more comfortable in the United States than Americans will be in India. And at a time when the major new economic growth prospects are in countries that look more like India than they do like America, Indians will be an incredibly mobile and flexible work population, having the very, very best that the world has to offer in terms of intellectual firepower and exposure to global economic systems, but also having grown up in environments where they know how to switch between different systems, and they are actually, even when very wealthy, quite comfortable living in a house which runs out of water quite often and runs out of electricity, and they're able to go into weird places in Central Asia and Africa and feel quite okay doing business there, knowing how things operate, knowing that even people who are turning over millions of dollars a year can do so without contracts, just on the basis of various forms of informal business ethics. So I think that as time goes on, America will retain its monopoly over certain things. India will never build a scientific research, an academic infrastructure that remotely rivals America's. It will continue to use America's and to supply America with talented people. And Indians who are interested in working in those kind of environments will come to the States. But India itself as a major economic opportunity will continue to mushroom in the next few years, and Indians will spread out into Africa and China and Central Asia and places like this with enormous ease and flexibility.
You know, Barack Obama spoke at a school. A child asked him, who would you have dinner with if you had a magic wand, living or dead? And he said, Gandhi. I asked Gandhi's grandson what Gandhi would say to Obama, especially in this decision around Afghanistan. And he said, no bones about it, he would see the United States in Afghanistan as Britain. And he said, remember above all the poorest people in the world, and that will guide your policy. What do you suppose, in a quiet moment at the White House, Prime Minister Singh whispered to Barack Obama about the Pakistan-Afghanistan riddle?
Manmohan Singh is a legendarily silent man. And I have difficulty imagining him doing anything so intimate or even expressive as whispering in Barack Obama's ear. But in a way, his silence is his asset and his virtue, because when you're trying to represent the interests of a country as diverse as India, anything you say is offensive to somebody. So remaining silent is a pretty wise course of action. But having said that, he has been ferociously committed to securing for India a certain kind of global prestige, prominence, and maneuverability in the last few years. And one of the ways that he's done that is to play very wisely in the whole regional game with America. I think Manmohan Singh essentially wants out of these local issues. He is sponsoring essentially a neoliberal economy that wants to get on and make money. And I think that he would like America to do as much of this work as possible.
India gives us these giant, world-class, sort of stereotypical figures to choose from. I'm just wondering, who among the plausible great men that India could choose from is the real spirit behind the new India? Is it Gandhi? Is it Ambani? Is it Neelakani? Is it somebody we've not even heard of? Who's the great man in the Indian imagination in a new century?
Well, for a lot of Indians, the great man is Lee Kuan Yew of Singapore. I mean, for a lot of Indians would like a Singaporean style society. That is their fantasy, in fact. Hygienic India, which just doesn't suffer from any of the kind of problems that thwart daily life in many cities.
And rich beyond the dreams of avarice.
Yes. I can't really sum up the place. I find that difficult. Certainly not in the figure of, in the biography of one man. Mukesh Ambani is kind of mythical because his father came from absolute poverty and built this empire, largely through his relationship with Indira Gandhi. And now Mukesh Ambani, of course, is legendarily powerful, controlling much of the petrochemical industry of India, having just built a house that cost $100 million. But in a way, his story is also very banal. It's a story that we know well from other places, and I don't think it really says very much beyond just the fact that in a country of a billion people, there will be two or three who have that.
Rana Desgupta, Salman Rushdie calls you the most unexpected and original Indian writer of his generation, and you're still in your 30s. It's a beautifully blurbable line, and yet you're really something quite different. You're not exactly an Indian writer. You're an English man with Indian heritage. I would put you in that growing group of transnational writers, global, planetary writers, who happens to have lit down on India for the while to observe and to write. What is your ambition as a writer of the whole world? And how is it different, really, from being an Indian writer?
I mean, the way that the publishing industry is organized is right now is that national affiliations seem to be very important, and people are categorized by their nations.
And their family names.
And their family names and their genetics. And this is ultimately, to me at least, completely uninteresting. I do describe myself as a writer from Delhi because I think that Delhi has been absolutely formative for me in the way that I write and all those kinds of things. But I don't like the idea of being sort of genetically predetermined in what I write, that I will therefore write about this range of subjects and all those kinds of things. And yes, I think that for me personally, the globe is the subject that I wish to take on. And there are things that are peculiarly magnetic about the globe that I'd like to write about. And they don't necessarily happen to be in my backyard. I mean, I'd like to write in the future about the Congo because I think the Congo is a place which summarizes an enormous amount of global process. But I have no organic relationship to it. I would have to go out and discover everything there. And I think that's part of the writer's job, and it's part of what writers have always done, is to find out about what they don't know about. The idea that a writer begins with all the answers and has some kind of sealed truth inside him, which he simply splurges onto the page, it may be the case that that's the experience of some writers, but it's not for me. I start a book in absolute unknowing, in absolute ignorance, not only of the factual material I wish to write about, but more importantly, of the philosophical questions I wish to explore through this book, and I learn as I write. And yes, I think that I'm not alone in this, that there are many other writers I can think of my generation, who feel that the fundamental interconnectedness of the whole planet is the ocean in which they wish to swim as writers.
Name a few of those others. I'm thinking there are so many different examples. Orhan Pamuk could write about Istanbul on the moon. And if he was on the moon, he probably would still be writing about Istanbul. Kazuo Ishiguro is another story entirely. He writes, as you do, about Central Europe, England, where he grew up, the whole globe in a sense. Who do you associate yourself with in that class of global writers? And who don't you?
Well, I think, you know, one of the writers I admire very much is Alexander Himon. Who comes from the former Yugoslavia and now lives in the US. And there's something about the energy of somebody that comes out of a traumatic situation, moves to another country, in a very short amount of time is writing in the language of that country, which is foreign to him. There's something about that energy which I admire, and which definitely transmits itself through the work. But I think also that the kind of life history that he has means that he's not afraid to preserve a certain madness in his writing, a certain kind of excess to the message. And I feel that this ability of a writer to embrace and confront that which is the surplus of life, the mad excess, I guess, is to me important. I think that writing is too pared down these days, too sane and too efficient. I admire a lot of American writers. I mean, I think that Jonathan Safran Foer has written some really wonderful stuff. And but in a way, he's also marking a kind of endpoint of fiction. He's so focused on the, and very brilliantly focused on the kind of technologies of language and writing, and almost throwing his hands up in some of his writing and saying, we can no longer say anything. We can just talk about the means by which we might say it. And there's a kind of spiritual decline that's implicit in a lot of his writing, which I think he signals so brilliantly that I think you can accept it. But I think there's a kind of, it's a pessimistic a body of work, whereas what I've tried to do in my work is to release new possibilities and not to be swayed by a very general feeling that the world is coming to an end and that there is nothing more to say. Because though that feeling masquerades as critique of the status quo, in fact it's become incredibly conservative, and a kind of excuse for not thinking, because anyway, there is nothing more to think. So there's the second half of my novel, Solo, and indeed is a kind of gesture towards a hopeful eruption of energy, which I think is somewhere latent in this world, but we don't exactly know how to access it.
It's a joy to speak with you, and it's a joy to read your work. Rana Dasgupta, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Paul McCarthy edited this conversation with Rana Dasgupta, whose novel Solo will be out in America next year. Our Brown University interns Hannah Olson and Ben Mandelkern are studying up on India with us this whole season. Suketu Mehta, the author of the classic Modern Portrait of Bombay, Maximum City, is up next in the Year of India series. Post your questions and answers and experiences of India, old and new, on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for joining the conversation.